Thank you, Doctor, for a wonderful explanation. I have a treat for you. Our last speaker of the day is John Lenchofsky. He was educated at the Thatcher School. He earned his BA from the University of California at Berkeley and his MA and his PhD from SAIS. He's the author of Sources of Soviet Perestroika and Soviet Perceptions of U.S. Foreign Policy, as well as numerous publications on the whole scope of foreign policy issues. Now, that's what I have to say, but what I really want to tell you is that he's made a tremendous contribution. He's one of these people who has gone out and done something virtually by himself that desperately needed doing that nobody else could have done. He's the founder and director of the Institute of World Politics, an independent graduate school of statecraft and national security affairs, which is affiliated with Boston University. He takes on the daunting task of educating those with most what the liberals call pressing human needs in the areas currently serving in the State Department, of people serving in the State Department, Defense Department of the United States, the intelligence agencies, educators, business executives, journalists, and diplomats. And these are not easily educable people. John is starting an interesting new addition to his program, and his subject is really daunting for the small amount of time we have this afternoon. It's the U.S., Europe, and Russia, alliances or confrontation. And so I gave him the additional onus of perhaps giving us, just because of the Philadelphia Society's enormous interest in young people and of bringing them into our society and educating them, I asked him if he could tell us just a tiny bit about what he's doing. John?
Thank you, Margot. It's a great pleasure and a privilege to be addressing all of you. I have so many friends in your number, and I'm indebted to so many of you for help on many fronts in the establishment of the Institute of World Politics. But having served in government on the Hill, in the State Department, and in the NSC, I came into contact with lots of people who were also serving in government, who I discovered had not been sufficiently trained in all sorts of elements of statecraft for them to do their jobs as professionally, skillfully as they could. And I also found that there has been a precipitous decline in civic education in this country, and an equally precipitous decline in the study of history, and therefore in the appreciation of our America's founding principles, our historical antecedents, and the various lessons that one should learn from history when it comes to matters of war and peace. And so it was with the suspicion that many of the elite schools in this field, that many of these schools have not been doing the job to produce well-formed practitioners of statecraft, that I attempted to found this new school. We are located, although we have an affiliation with Boston University that grants academic credit for our courses, we're located in Washington, D.C., in the heart of downtown, and which is why we have such a high percentage of people already working in the government studying with us. But we just started an independent master's degree program just this last January. The university continues to grant academic credit for our individual courses while we launch the process of independent accreditation. So this is where we are, and we have some literature out here, some blue brochures and some excerpts of our catalog for those of you who are interested and who may want to send some students our way. We're also on the web. Thank you for that opportunity, Margot. I would like to talk today about some of the issues concerning Russia and Europe. This is really a mixed bag. It's a vast collection of subjects, and so I'm going to go through a kind of an eclectic collection of my own concerns in hopes that they have something to do with general U.S. national interests and your own interests. As we look at Eurasia, or at least the European side of it all, we confront an array of problems these days that could conceivably have tremendous implications for the future well-being of our country and peace in the world. Starting with Russia, this is a regime that is now increasingly ruled by an authoritarian KGB slash criminal regime. There is, you know, while one can look for good sides to the development, to various developments in Russia, there are this constantly each week there are new developments that come up that cause one to be worried. We've been witnessing the spectacle of the crushing of the freedom of the press. The independent media has been on the ropes for really quite a long time, and it's also been rather dispiriting to note that the main TV station that has been independent in Russia has been run by not all that sterling a character in the first place. You have a situation where you've got a criminal class that has been dominating the economy. This happened as a result of various elements of Western-induced economic shock therapy, which involved the freeing of prices without the creation of private property, which enabled monopoly institutions, state-run monopoly institutions that were being privatized by the so-called nomenclatura to start charging monopoly prices and impoverishing people throughout the country. Superficially, some of these things looked like market reforms. In fact, they produced an enormous economic catastrophe for the country, to the extent that average people in Russia today long for the good old days of Soviet communism. This is a situation where these criminal mafias have organized their own gangs. They have their own private armies. They've assassinated bankers that didn't cooperate and have taken over their own banks. There's a virtually complete absence of a rule of law. There has not been a real establishment of an independent judiciary. We witness the continuing spectacle of capital flight, and one wonders why anybody in the West would want to invest in Russia when the conditions are so unpropitious for Russians to invest there themselves. You've got the war in Chechnya, which continues day in and day out, week in and week out. It's essentially off the radar screen of the world's consciousness, because basically we've got sufficient press censorship that's going on there so that the regime can continue to crush the independence rebellion and without particularly having to deal with any international concern. When it comes to matters of defense and military affairs, the conventional forces in Russia have been collapsing, and they're demoralized. There has been a draft evasion. There have been criminals released from prison in order to be drafted into the war in Chechnya, for example. Extraordinarily unpleasant spectacle. But one thing that is going on is that there continues to be a major strategic modernization going on in Russia, where we see, again, the unpleasant sight of American non-Luger monies appropriated by our Congress, designed originally to dismantle their nuclear weapons, which, in fact, this money is going to subsidize strategic modernization, new submarines, new missiles, and the continued development of chemical and biological weapons in violation of treaties. Which then brings me to the next issue, which is the continued Russian violation of virtually all the arms control treaties. One of the worst things about the American foreign policy establishment is that it's conducted arms control for well over half a century, and during this entire period it has never developed a compliance policy, an enforcement policy, some kind of policies where our interlocutors and contracting parties in arms control arrangements would be given some kind of deterrent to violating them, perhaps some kind of incentive, some kind of foreknowledge that we would do X if they did Y. And, well, so long as we don't have an enforcement policy, they continue to violate, and it seems to make no difference to the foreign policy establishment. Along with this, of course, is the massive proliferation of weapons, fissile materials, and one suspects of chemical and biological agents, of other kinds of conventional weapons. There have been major surface combatants and even submarines that one understands that have been sold in open markets by corrupt military officers to rogue states and other other groups. Underlying all of this is an abiding resentment in the foreign policy and military establishment in Russia of their loss of empire and their loss to the United States in the Cold War. And it's a seething resentment. Many of these people who are in the foreign policy and military establishment in Russia are members of the old communist nomenklatura. They're members of the old KGB apparatus. By the way, an apparatus which is utterly unreformed, and a set of institutions, even though the KGB itself was divided up into several different agencies. One of them, there's the FSB, the SVR, and there's also an organization called FOPSI, which is sort of like the National Security Agency in the United States. It intercepts all the communications, except it is also curiously given the responsibilities for monitoring and controlling all financial transactions within the country. And so it's as if you had sort of the most secret U.S. spy agency in sync with the Securities and Exchange Commission and all of the major telecommunications operations of Wall Street all built into one agency. These are organizations, one should say, that are completely incompatible with liberty and democracy. Well, the Russians are resenting their current circumstances. They have not realized particularly any prosperity. They're not feeling any of the wonderful warm breezes of liberty. They have lost the fear and the respect that other people used to accord them during the Soviet period. And so the result of this is a number of different policies. One, of course, is the attempt to rebuild the Soviet empire, at least geographically, not necessarily under an ideological banner, but to reincorporate the many of the non-Russian territories within a common economic and political and security zone. This has been done to a certain extent under the ill-concealed rubric of the so-called Commonwealth of Independent States, but today an extraordinary number of these of the post-Soviet states have Russian troops on their borders and have been coerced in a number of different ways back into the fold. Some of the ways this has been done has been by the exploitation of inter-ethnic conflicts in many of these countries. Arnold Beichmann mentioned earlier the the conflict between Georgia and its minority group in the Northwest called the Abkhaz. Well, this is one of these remarkable manipulations by the old KGB, where when the Georgians were trying to declare independence, the Abkhaz, all of a sudden, this Abkhaz minority decides that it's going to declare independence. And as a colleague of mine says, in the greatest miracle since the loaves and the fishes, the Abkhaz acquired an army, a navy, and an air force, and put Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia, at its mercy, until finally Fast Eddie, my affectionate name for Edward Shevardnadze, the president, had to show up in Moscow and declare that, yes, after all, he would join the Commonwealth of Independent States. Well, accompanying these kinds of policies have been attempts, of course, to contain American power. We all know very well about the opposition to the expansion of NATO, but the resentment of the United States by elements within Russia and the ruling elements has been such that it has taken what I consider to be an extraordinarily perverse step of seeking a strategic cooperation with China and sending all of its most sophisticated weapons, or many of them at least, to China in an interest of trying to combat American alleged hegemonism. The strange thing about this, of course, is that the single greatest objective threat that the Russians face is from China itself. It is the Chinese that have been engaging in demographic conquest, so to speak, of Eastern Siberia by bringing in some of their labor force into Siberia and establishing a demographic fait accompli. This isn't something that's happening immediately, but it's happening over time, and Russians who care about the territorial integrity of their country are concerned about this, and know it's not going to go away quickly or easily. Well, we have not always been helpful in all of these matters. Our intervention into Kosovo and using NATO as the vehicle to do so was something that fueled enormous suspicion amongst the Russians about our own and NATO's motivations. And so the Russians have revived their long-standing efforts to try to push the United States out of Europe, to sever the relationship between Western Europe and the United States. They have begun a certain level of cooperation with Germany, so either you can call it Rapallo style or Molotov-Ribbentrop style, although it isn't fully developed, but they find that there is a certain greater commonality dealing with the German Social Democrats than with the conservatives. They have attempted to try to attract the Europeans through their own independent missile defense plan as a way of kind of reviving their concepts of European collective security, again, as a substitute for NATO. Well, Russia, ultimately, the problem is ultimately a political cultural one, which doesn't have any easy answers. Russia is a bundle of psychological complexes, that it is suffering from bruised pride, which causes it to take some of these counterproductive actions. And it is, the thing is that these actions tend to alienate the United States and perhaps some others in the West, and yet it still has an abiding interest in maintaining good economic relations with the United States and maintaining open credit lines. Then again, of course, it engages in these counterproductive actions, harming its own security by arming China. Now, moving west, Western Europe is suffering its own brand of decay, which concerns me. And there's so much that can be said, I'm just going to do a very selective tour d'horizon here. I believe that Europe is suffering from a kind of a spiritual political decay that is threatening its ability to preserve and ultimately defend its own liberty. It has a political class that is pushing for European unity. But this European unity, as we're seeing, is increasingly animated by a kind of a socialist vision which involves the sacrificing of national sovereignty to the bureaucratic decisions of a bunch of Brussels-based Euro-socialists. It is a vision that would deny national identity, and which is something which comes up against this problem of national identity whenever it is put to a referendum, such as the Danish vote on the euro. The Euro-socialist imagination has most recently come up with this plan complaining about competitive taxation. Now, after decades, if not centuries, that the Irish have figured out that low taxation produces prosperity, they're mad at the Irish for becoming prosperous and attracting capital and so on and so forth, and they want the Irish to raise their taxes to bring themselves down to the same lowest common denominator as all the other socialist basket cases. The Europeans are opposing U.S. missile defense plans. They're remarkably uninformed about them, and they really have no clue as to what the general strategic philosophy is behind our missile defenses. And they think that if we're just going to try to use a few radars in Northern Europe as a way of trying to defend America uniquely and abandoning Europe entirely. This, of course, is a severe misunderstanding, at least of what the Bush administration presumably plans to do. But remember, we just went through a Clinton administration which was busy pushing a missile plan that was designed to encourage the Europeans to believe this, so that the Europeans would oppose it, so that ultimately we wouldn't have a missile defense at all. And that's how Clinton managed, in his remarkable inverted way, to support putatively a missile defense plan while in fact trying to kill it. Europe wants to create its own independent defense force. This is something that perhaps people who believe in the continued necessity of NATO think might be potentially a threat. I don't think it's that much of a threat, because the warrior ethos in Europe is so dead that anything that they do to try to create a new separate defense force is in fact, as my friend Angelo Codevilla says, just a reordering of organization charts without the deployment or the training of a single new soldier or weapons system. The whole concept that the Europeans have of how to achieve security is something that is essentially that security is achieved through arms control and through endless diplomatic negotiations deriving from their cult of diplomatism, which of course is the same deformation professionnelle of every foreign ministry in the world, including our own State Department, but in any event, it is there in spades in Europe. In Europe, as in many sectors in the United States, there is the abiding sort of principle or assumption that security is a free good, when in fact it's not. So what we're seeing in Europe is an extraordinary irresponsibility of matters of security. It's the behavior, in a way, of a spoiled brat. And of course, it derives to a very large extent because of Europe's long-time dependence on the United States. Now, I happen to be one who believes that NATO is a good thing. I believe there ought to be an alliance of Western civilization, even if there isn't a common immediate enemy, and that intelligent political leadership can manage such an alliance even in relative times of peace. But the United States does have a dilemma. it's time, in a sense, to let the Europeans grow up a little bit and become a little bit more responsible for their own defense. And while many of my colleagues feel as though France, for example, is just this awful pain in the neck for our diplomacy, that they're spying on us and they steal our technology secrets and they thumb their nose at us on Middle Eastern policy and they do all of these other kinds of things, I frankly am rather tickled by the French behavior. I don't think it's all that threatening, and I think it's a sign that they still have a little testosterone left in them. They still want their own force de frappe, as they say. And I believe that if they have it, if they're jealous enough about their national identity and their civilization, that perhaps if there came down to be a real war threatening our civilization, I'd rather have the French armies more or less having a little element of jealous, stubborn independence. Well, I don't want to usurp all of the time here, but let me just say a couple of concluding remarks here about I still believe the United States is the only power capable of exercising any real leadership in Europe in a way that does not revive old geopolitical rivalries. I believe NATO has been an extremely good investment in peace. I think that we would have seen many more Balkan-like situations in other parts of Eastern Europe if there hadn't been actual incentives for many of these countries to behave themselves and to try to develop themselves into democracies as the price of joining this alliance. So I think it's been a good investment for all of its imperfections. But, of course, an alliance is not going to be worth anything if its members are impotent and irresponsible. So I believe there has to be some kind of new management of this in order to improve the maturity of European security philosophy. But at the larger problem here, both in Europe and in Russia, And what lies at the root of all of this is a common theme, which I believe contains a kernel for the larger long-term solution to the problem of the building and the defense of liberty. And this is that the foundations of liberty are ultimately moral foundations. And I recently, Margaret Thatcher was quoting John Adams, who said that the American Constitution is something that is designed only for a virtuous and a moral and religious people, and it is wholly inadequate for any other type of people. It is my view that, at least in Russia, for example, they are not going to overcome their inability to build a free political economy until they can ingest this particular lesson, until they can undergo some kind of a moral revival. In Russia, they suffer from a moral deformation. Bob Riley called it a moral Chernobyl in a particularly felicitous phrase, caused by 7 decades of communism. And what is really going on in Russia today, in my view, is a continuation or a mutation of the Cold War, where you have, and I always understood the Cold War as a war between those on the one hand who believe that there is an objective, transcendent, universal moral order in the world, and those who reject this. And therefore, moral standards are determined by who has the biggest guns and the greatest will to use them. In other words, a doctrine of might makes right. And the people in Russia today who are ruling, the KGB, mafia, fascist, communist nexus at the helm of the entire society, are people who basically live by the doctrine of might makes right. And they are at war, essentially, over in a conflict over what kind of moral order there should be with the ordinary people, the ones who took to the streets by the hundreds of thousands against the communist regime in the interest of building what they called a normal society, something where there would be a rule of law and not capricious arbitrariness when it came to matters of justice. But the problem is, might makes right prevails. There's a low level of trust. When there's no trust, you can't have proper long-term transactions and so on and so forth. And you have a climate which absolutizes power and which denies the transcendent dignity of the individual and his inalienable rights. The ordinary people are demoralized. There is no active good dissident movement. And they're alien, and Russian people are alienated from what they think is Western capitalism, when in fact this has not been what we have given them. But this is what they've come to believe, and so they long for the good old days. What, you know, is there some hope here? The Russian Orthodox Church is not an immediate source of potential moral revival. It's still unrepentant. Its patriarch is either an agent or a co-optee of the KGB. It has to engage in some kind of repentance, so to speak, publicly, if it's going to purge itself of the old ghosts. In Western Europe, and here in the United States, we are suffering from what I consider to be the effects of the communists' own insights on these moral matters during the Cold War. Both Lenin and after him, Antonio Gramsci, recognized that the overthrow of a liberal democracy had to have a moral cultural component. They understood the ancient Roman historian Livy, who said that the best way to defeat the enemy is to promote the ideas of hedonism and selfishness in his society. And then he'll become rotten and he'll become incapable of defending himself. And he'll start, in the modern context, thinking about defense in solely commercial or technological solutions. But Solzhenitsyn said, security doesn't come from nuclear umbrellas. It comes from stout hearts and from steadfast men. And what are they steadfast about? They're steadfast about their fundamental adherence to certain types of transcendent principles. Anyway, it's enough for me to say thank you all for listening.